I will now turn the time over to our moderator, Dr. Heather Henry, the Program Administrator of the Superfund Basic Research Program, to introduce our first presenter. Heather?
Thanks, Justin. Today's seminar demonstrates how plants can be used to ameliorate conditions where metals are the driver for site remediation. So unlike organic contaminants, which were the focus of the first two sessions in this series, metals are elements and therefore cannot be broken down into less harmful metabolites. So while dig and haul is one approach for metal contaminated sites, the cost can be prohibitive, especially when contamination extends for acres. So this is the case in today's presentations, where they'll be talking about former agricultural and mining areas where the contamination extends for large areas. Our first speaker, Dr. Blaylock, will present an approach for metal remediation whereby plants are used to extract metals from soil, a process called phytoextraction. And our second speaker, Dr. Mayer, uses plant covers to stabilize mine tailings to prevent erosion and has optimized this process for a particularly dry environment. So without further ado, let's move on to our presentation. Our first speaker is Dr. Michael Blaylock. He's the Vice President of Systems Development at Eden Space Systems Corporation, where he leads research and commercial development activities of environmental phytotechnologies. Before joining Eden Space, Dr. Blaylock was laboratory head at Phytotech, where he supervised a research team developing phytoremediation technologies. He received his BS and MS in agronomy from Brigham Young University. He got his PhD in soil chemistry from the University of Maryland and his postdoc from Rutgers University. The title of his talk is Phytoextraction of Arsenic Using Terrace Ferns. Welcome, Dr. Blaylock.
Thank you, Heather. Well, I'll give you a little bit of introduction about Eden Space. Eden Space, for those of you that may not be familiar with us, we're a dedicated phytoremediation company. Have done a lot of that work for a number of years and focused primarily on remediation of metal-contaminated soils. Over the last 7 to 8 years, the majority of our effort has been focused towards arsenic. Because of some things that we'll talk about today, arsenic presents some rather unique challenges as well as it being well-suited for phytoremediation in a lot of instances. So we'll start off, the title slide is slide number 2, and we'll start from there, so if you want to advance to the next slide. So on slide number 3, let's talk a little bit about arsenic phytoremediation and what some of the requirements are and why it's suitable for phytoremediation. One of the things we find over the last decade is that we're getting more and more attention devoted towards arsenic. And mainly that's because we're seeing a lot of housing expansion onto former agricultural lands, particularly in areas of apple and citrus orchards where arsenic was used extensively. You know, arsenic excavation and disposal works very well for soils that are, you know, low volume of soil, low mass of soil. But when you start looking at areas such as orchards and agricultural areas that are quite extensive, excavation and disposal really becomes an issue as far as the cost. If we look at arsenic chemistry, arsenic exists primarily in the soil as an anion. Usually we find it as arsenate in the arsenate form. The solubility is fairly limited, and it doesn't tend to move much. Now, that's a good thing from the aspect of the arsenic is still in the surface soil. It hasn't moved down beyond the root zone, so that makes it suitable for phytoremediation in that case. On the other hand, the low solubility sometimes limits its availability for plant uptake. But typically, we find arsenic in the surface soils. The top 6 inches or the top 15 centimeters is not uncommon, even after 40 or 50 years of arsenic being from when it was deposited. The other thing that we find about arsenic is it has relatively low regulatory limits compared to some of the other metals that we deal with. Typically, in the U.S., we find arsenic targets between about 1 part per million to 20 part per million in the soil. So when you start looking at that from a phytoremediation perspective, that's good in the aspect that we're not having to remove hundreds of parts per million in most cases, because we're finding that the soil concentrations in most cases are less than 100 parts per million. Rarely do they exceed 200 parts per million for most of the soils that we deal with. Certainly there are hot spots on many sites that could exceed that. But for when we look at pesticide applications or soils that have been affected by copper chromated arsenate from wood preservatives, these large areas, typically we're finding concentrations that are down closer into 50 parts per million. And so the amount of arsenic that has to be removed through plant uptake is much lower than what we find with some of our other metals, such as zinc or nickel, lead, things like that, where we're having to, you know, we're starting at concentrations that may be in excess of 1,000 parts per million. So it has some factors there that favor its removal through phytoremediation. So if we're looking at removing something going from 30 parts per million to 20 parts per million, that's a 10 part per million decrease. That's something that's feasible through phytoremediation. So let's move on to the next slide, in slide 4. We had done work previously at Phytotech for a number of years trying to look at arsenic and really weren't very successful in finding any plants that accumulated arsenic. And around in 1999, Dr. Lena Ma had published some results describing a fern that she had discovered that accumulated very high concentrations of arsenic. And she was reporting concentrations greater than 20,000 parts per million in the fronds. And while we've seen that, and the ferns are very capable of doing that, typically we find when we grow these ferns on contaminated soils, we typically see concentrations down closer in the 1,000 to, you know, up to 8,000 parts per million. But typically it's in that 1,000 to 5,000 part per million range. And that's reflective of the availability of arsenic in the soil. The interesting thing about these ferns is they accumulate arsenic at both very low soil concentrations as well as high soil concentrations. So they have a wide range of suitability if you're looking at their tolerance to arsenic. They can tolerate very high concentrations in the soil. The arsenic is accumulated primarily in the fronds. We don't tend to get very much of an accumulation in the roots. It's translocated pretty quickly up into the fronds, which makes it, again, a very suitable plant for phytoremediation. Now, ferns in general are a lot more difficult to grow than some of the other plants that we would like to have, but this is one of those plants where we don't really have a lot of choices. The terrace ferns are really about the only thing that we've found that accumulate arsenic to any great degree. Advance to the next slide, slide number 5. Some of the things we have to deal with this particular fern, with the terrace genus, is they tend to be tropical or semi-tropical plants. They grow very well in those conditions, but we don't have a lot of properties in the U.S. necessarily that fall into that category. Certainly there are some as we go to the southeast U.S. where the terrace ferns grow very well, but as we move to the northern climates, it presents some challenges as to how we can use this fern for phytoremediation. We can grow it certainly as an annual, and you can plant it in the spring, you transplant it in the spring, harvest in the fall, and it does very well. It's just that there's some increased requirements as far as replanting that every year that you'd like to be able to get around. But as we grow it in if you look at the climate zones 8 and above, it'll typically thrive as a perennial and will do quite well. As we get to the, you know, zone 7 and below, which is about where we're at here in Virginia, that doesn't tend to survive the winters as well. We get some survival, maybe about 30% survival here during the winter, depending on the severity of our winters, but that kind of gives you the indication of where it's adaptable as a perennial. So we treat it as an annual in most of the sites that we work with it. It will tolerate some, for instance, our ferns here. We still have ferns that are alive that are outside now, haven't frozen, but once the temperatures get down much below about 25 degrees Fahrenheit, we don't get much survival after that. So let's advance to the next slide, slide 6. There are several different species or varieties in the terrace genus that we found that do well and accumulate arsenic. Terrace cretica mayi is one plant that we've used. If you'll advance to the next slide, Terrace multifida is another terrace fern that accumulates arsenic. We had looked at various species to try to find some that were a little more cold tolerant that might be adapted to some of the conditions where we're working. The next slide, slide number 8, shows some of the interesting features about the way this plant accumulates arsenic. This particular slide shows some data that was obtained in hydroponic studies. We were looking at arsenic uptake and comparing Pteris vittata to the Boston fern, which is a non-accumulator, the N. exaltata. And it's very interesting in the way that the Pteris vittata accumulates arsenic. This particular study was done with radio-labeled arsenic. so we could trace the arsenic from the solution up into their roots and fronds. And you can see in this, after exposing these plants to arsenic in a hydroponic solution after 6 hours, we're already seeing that arsenic being translocated into the shoots. After 24 hours, on the second bar, you can see that all of the arsenic had been removed from the water. We had the majority of it was into the fronds, whereas in the non-accumulating fern, most of the arsenic was still left in the water. We had some accumulation in the roots, very little, if any, translocation to the shoots. And so this is really the mechanism that we like to see when we're looking at removing a metal from the environment through plant uptake. So we go to the next slide. This shows you some of the capabilities as far as how it can function in removing arsenic from water. This was data was generated as actually as part of a pilot project where we were looking at removing arsenic from drinking water in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The arsenic concentrations in the drinking water to start off were fairly low, and on this figure, the green diamonds on the figure represent the arsenic concentration in the influent water. This was the tap water that was being used. And so those concentrations hovered right around between, say, 8 and 12 parts per million. Parts per billion in the water. And so that's about the standard of 10 part per billion is where we were looking to achieve our concentrations. And so we had some fluctuation right around that limit. Many of the communities, though, in that area are struggling to reach that 10 part per billion limit. If you look at this particular data, though, the interesting thing is the blue diamonds, which is the effluent arsenic, after we passed it through a hydroponic system where the ferns were growing, is all below the limit of 2 parts per billion. So we are very effective in removing arsenic from that water, even at very low concentrations. I think that has some important implications as we study this fern and learn about how it accumulates arsenic, that it's able to remove arsenic from solutions with very low concentrations. I think that has some relevance as we look at soil solution and how the fern is able to accumulate arsenic from a sources of limited solubility in the soil. The black line on this figure shows the flow rate, which we started off of a fairly low flow rate of 100 gallons per day, and then we increased that at the end. We wanted to see just how much this particular system could handle. And even at the elevated flow rates, we were still successful in removing arsenic. So this kind of data then suggests that, these ferns should be successful in taking arsenic out of the soil. The question is, how do we adapt that then to a soil system or to a remediation system? So if we move to the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit today about a couple of projects we've done recently. One will focus mainly on a project we've done here in Washington, D.C. in the Spring Valley area. This is a residential area that we've been working on for about 5 years working with existing residential homes where they've had arsenic contamination around in their yards. And the second project that we'll talk about briefly is a site down in central Virginia, which was a former orchard use. This project was conducted actually by EPA Region 3, where we provided ferns, and the goal there was to remove some of these areas to use phytoremediation to try to address some of these areas that had elevated arsenic concentrations. Let's move on to the next slide, on slide 11. And we'll talk about Spring Valley. So Spring Valley is a formerly used defense site. What that means is it was basically during World War I, this area of Washington, D.C. was a weapons testing center for the Army. It eventually developed into American University was what became of that area after World War I. But one of the weapons that was being tested at that time were some chemical weapons that were arsenic-based compounds. And as a result, the arsenic was distributed in several areas there. Around in the late 90s, as there was construction work going on, there were some discoveries of some buried pits that had various compounds in there that were related to the chemical weapons. And that triggered a sampling event that revealed a lot of arsenic in that particular area. There were a number of homes with elevated arsenic concentrations in and around their yards and existing landscaping and that sort of thing. So the question then came up was, how is that can be addressed? And in many cases, the answer was we're going to excavate the soil and remove that arsenic from around the people's homes to remove that hazard. But in some cases, there were existing trees and landscaping features that people were somewhat reluctant to lose through the excavation process. And so that's when we were contacted, Eden Space was contacted by the Corps of Engineers to see if there was something, some way that we could incorporate phytoremediation into this type of a project with, and maintain the existing trees and other features there. So if we'll go to the next slide, in slide 12, this will give you an idea of how the approach was for this particular area. This particular area, which was ended up being about approximately 1 square mile, was delineated and divided up into a 20 by 20 foot grid for sampling. And then from each one of those grids, there was a core taken from the center to determine what the arsenic concentration was. Any of those grids that exceeded 20 parts per million were then selected for a remediation activity. And typically the goal in those properties was to clean to 20 parts per million, although there was a higher limit of 43 parts per million that was negotiated depending on the exposure and some of the other circumstances there. And so then as those plots were identified that had elevated arsenic, then a plan was developed for each one of those areas, and depending on the homeowner willingness and what they wanted to do, considered as part of an option there for remediating those sites. And the main goal of this particular project was to see how phytoremediation could be incorporated. Was it something that would work? Was it feasible for this type of a remediation? So let's move to the next slide, slide 13. And give you a little bit of background about how this has developed. So this started with a laboratory feasibility study in 2003 that was conducted by the Army Corps of Engineers, where they did greenhouse studies to basically establish the feasibility, how well the ferns would grow in the soil, would they take up arsenic, could this be done under a greenhouse type of conditions. That led, because of the results there were favorable, that led to an initial field verification study in 2004. Which consisted of about three. There were 20 by 20 plots, which we called grids or plots. Each one of those was a separate plot, and we used approximately 2,800 plants that were transplanted into these plots to evaluate their arsenic uptake and removal. The results in 2004 were favorable, and so that project then was expanded in 2005 to consist of additional properties, additional plots, and a lot more plants that expanded up to 10,000 plants that were transplanted. In 2006 was about the same level, a little bit more, 13 properties and 48 plots. 2007 we had cleaned up a lot of the properties we had done previously, so we started to scale back, and we were at 6 properties and 19 plots, and in 2008 we had scaled back even more to 3 properties and 16 plots. So the field verification study kind of ramped up, reached its peak, and now it's tailing off, and we're almost completed with those properties. So while the initial objectives of this project were to try to get a handle on how well the arsenic or how well the ferns would grow, would they take up arsenic, then as the project evolved, we discovered that there were some additional things that we needed to learn about. And one was to look at the various conditions. In a residential area, you have a wide range of conditions. If you can imagine people's yards, some of them might be a backyard that's very well shaded. Others could be a front yard that has full exposure to sun. Soil types vary, and there's a lot of different conditions that exist in different as you drive around different neighborhoods. And so we wanted to, some of that was to try to get a handle on how it worked at different locations. Another thing that's very important, I think, for phytoremediation is to have multiple seasons or continuous seasons. Many times we try to judge phytoremediation on a very short-term project. We do a pilot scale or a treatability study that might last for a very short period of time, and it's very difficult sometimes to evaluate that process with that shortened time period. We know that phytoremediation typically takes, at least 1 year, and many times, 3 years, 4 years to accomplish the purposes, because it's you're trading off time for money type of thing. you have to give the plants time to act and to be able to function. And many times we have to evaluate phytoremediation over a very short period of time because before we go full scale, we don't have time to stretch that process out. But that was one advantage of this particular project, is we were able to work on some of these sites over multiple seasons and have a continuous study that really was providing us data that we didn't have before. One of the other challenges of phytoremediation is reducing the uncertainty associated with the soil sampling. That's a big issue with phytoremediation. It's something that you have to address up front, is to determine how you want to sample and what do you expect your sampling to tell you. So if we'll advance to the next slide, slide number 15. If we think of how to assess phytoextraction performance, we have to remember that phytoextraction is an in-situ technology. So that means we have to sample the soil, we do our phytoremediation, then we come back and try to sample the same soil later. Well, as you know, if you sample the first time, that soil that you're measuring is no longer there on the site anymore. You've removed that sample. And you'd say, well, okay, that's, you know, we're sampling the same general area, should be fine. And it should be. But what we find is sometimes on many sites there is an extreme amount of variability associated with the soils. And you have to get a handle on that variability to understand what your sampling requirements are. So there's different purposes. This might be one sampling scheme that is very useful for assessing the site status and identifying, is there a problem? Are there things that we need to do? That might be the purpose of one sampling scheme. But then when you want to evaluate phytoremediation performance, that same sampling scheme may not be applicable. Because as we found out in the Spring Valley site, taking one sample out of the center of a 20 by 20 grid, that tells you whether that grid has an elevated concentration. But if you're just planting that area with ferns, it doesn't allow you really to assess the performance because you're basing it on that one location. So you need to adapt your sampling plan that's going to be a little bit different as you're assessing phytoremediation. It's a different purpose than determining whether you need to do something there. And so that's one consideration. And then also, as you look at the analytical variability, if you think of method 3050, which is what we typically use for metals, is that the analytical variability for some of these metals is fairly large. As we look at that method and you look at interlab comparisons, that it's not always as repeatable as what you would think it should be. Even when you use some of the standard reference soils, there's a substantial variability between labs. And then you also have the variability of the sampling. If you have particulates in your soil that influence those concentrations, that can be a very challenging scenario. And then the last factor is that many times the magnitude of effect, what we're expecting to see is less than the sampling error. So if you expect the plant is going to decrease the soil concentration by 10 parts per million, and then you run your duplicates and your duplicate samples aren't any closer than 10 parts per million, you're like, okay, how much of this can I believe and how do I get my hands on that? So those are some of the challenges with phytoremediation. They're not insurmountable, but they're things that you have to take into account as you start looking at this technology. So if you'll move to the next slide, slide 16, as you look at the way we started to approach this, initially, our first field verification, we started off with a 5-point composite sample. Now, if you'll remember back what I talked about, that initial grab sample taken out of the center of the grid on this particular chart, that red dot represents that initial sampling. Sample that was taken. So we set up a 5-point composite, 4 from each quadrant, and then 1 from the center where that initial sample was taken. Those 5 points were composited together into a single sample. The figure on the square on the right indicates that in some locations, because of the way the grid was oriented and the house was there, sometimes that center of the grid wasn't really in the center of the plot where we treated, and so it was moved just a little bit. And so we made some adjustments there. It's not that significant, but I just wanted to point that out. But the main idea was we wanted to do a composite sample to try to get something representative from the site. And so we would take that initial a composite, and then at the end of the season take another one. We also took an initial grab sample from a single point in the center at the beginning and at the end to try to see how that compared. If you'll move to the next slide, slide number 17, shows you some of the things that came out of that initial field verification that were kind of puzzling. There's a lot of numbers here, and so I'll try to walk you through the important ones. I've bolded some of them to draw your attention to them. So in this particular plot, which we'll call 15A, we had an initial sample. The initial sample from the grid is in what we call our 2001 grid sample. And that was the sample that was taken to identify whether that particular grid or plot was elevated. And so you'll see, if you look down that, you'll see some of those. The first one was 156 parts per million, 122, 126. So they have some fairly high numbers there. As we came in and did our five-point composite a few years later, those numbers weren't, they're not exactly the same. You see a lot of variation, but, okay, the same general trend kind of exists as far as the levels. And then when we took our post-harvest, after we planted our ferns and we came in at the end of the year, harvested the ferns, took the post-harvest samples, you see some changes there that then you start to have to question. And so you say in the first one, it went from 139 down to 53 parts per million. Well, as much as that's a favorable result from the aspect of the soil, arsenic concentration decreases, you kind of have to question that and say, well, do the ferns really remove, you know, that much arsenic? Do they really take it from 140 down to 50? And you're like, well, I don't really think the ferns do all that well. You know, they might do okay, but that's a little bit more than what you would expect. On the other hand, if you go down to plot D, occasionally you would see numbers that increase. They went from 95 to 122. And then again, you say, well, where does the arsenic come from? Why would it increase so much? And you have to start looking at this and saying, well, I think there's a problem here with the sampling and that we're not getting representative samples. Something is happening here that's not really going to help us decide whether the ferns are removing arsenic or not. So if you'll move on to the next slide, slide 18. So what we decided to do after that was, let's change our sampling scheme. And we went and adjusted after having some discussions with some scientists at the Corps of Engineers that had done a lot of work in this area as far as looking at explosives and things like that where particulates were a real issue. We decided to adopt a 30-point composite sampling scheme from each grid. And so in this particular approach, we would take 30 one-inch cores from 0 to 6 inch depth, and then those samples would all be composited in the field to yield a 2 to 3 kilogram sample. Then we would take that sample, and that sample would be sieved and milled to reduce the particle size and really make it a homogeneous sample, and then submit a subsample of that to the laboratory for analysis. As part of that, we would take duplicate composite samples from at least 10% of our grids to try to get a handle on the variability. And we'll move to the next slide. Slide number 19 gives you an idea of how this was done. This is one particular property where we had six locations we needed to sample. Now you'll notice that each one of those grids are not the same size, because you have a property line or a road or something that cuts off some of those grids where you can't do any work or can't sample them. And so on this particular slide, you have six grids, A, B, C, D, E, and F. And we took 30 points. Regardless of the size of the grid, we would take 30 cores from that particular plot. And then in plot F, we would take it, as it illustrated here, where that would indicate the duplicate sample. So we took a separate sample from that plot. And that was our approach to try to get a handle on some of this variability that we had to deal with. We move to the next slide, slide number 20. This will give you an idea of how some of the plots were laid out at various properties. One of the challenges we had, for instance, in the figure on the left, where you see that one labeled A and B, the first year we did this, we came back at the end of the season and we sampled the grid, and that area where we'd planted would look good. The arsenic concentration had gone down, and we had to sample sidewalls, because even if you're doing excavation, one of the things at the end of the excavation was you had to sample sidewalls. And so we had to follow that same approach. What we found is, when we sampled the edges where the ferns weren't planted right along the boundaries, that sometimes that sidewall might still be high. And so the following years, what we decided to do is do that sidewall sampling at the beginning of the year to know if the sidewall was high, that we needed to extend that grid out into the neighboring grid. And so if you look at plot B, you'll see how that grid was extended out into the neighboring grid because the sidewall came back elevated at the initial sampling. And so we would do that sampling at the beginning of the season to determine whether we needed to extend the planting area. The arsenic doesn't know that that's the, it doesn't know that that's the boundary of the plot and that it should stop where you end up planting. So you want to make sure you do that, because there's no reason to have to come back in a whole nother year just because you didn't plant another 5 feet over. So we would do that approach and sample out 5 feet and then further out as needed. And if the figure on the right, you'll see that sometimes those areas ended up being very small areas that we had to plant. And, this comes back to somewhat of a regulatory question as to what's the smallest unit that you should sample and identify. But because that was located on a particular property and the sample collected from that grid was elevated, that grid needed to be treated. And so sometimes we planted very small areas that were, a little bit challenging to work with at times. So move on to the next slide, slide 21. So the way that works is we transplanted the ferns into the site in early May, and we used approximately 12-inch plant spacings up until this year, where we increased our planting density. We wanted to get a little bit tighter density this year, so we went with 8-inch spacings in 2008. The ferns are grown throughout the summer. We provide water, we irrigate, we fertilize, and then those are sampled in. We sample the soil and the plants in late September to determine where we're at as far as concentrations go, and then depending on the concentration of the plant and the biomass we know, or the soil, we know whether we're going to have to continue that plot into the next year or not. Once we have that data back, then we come back, we harvest the ferns, the biomass, we have that characterized to know how we dispose of the waste, whether it's a hazardous waste or not, depending on how much arsenic is in the plant material. Plots that are going to be continued till the next year, we'll mulch over, and then plots that achieve the target, if they're below the target concentration, if they're below 20, then we would restore them with sod or whatever needs to be to restore them to their initial condition. One of the big challenges with ferns is that they don't grow from seed, they grow from spores, and as such we have to grow them in a greenhouse and transplant those plants into the site. And so if you start thinking about transplanting 10,000 or 20,000 plants, it's a fairly significant number of plants. If you look at the next slide on slide 22, that's our grower down in Florida who grows the plants for us. It's a significant number of ferns that are grown there for us each year. Slide 23 gives you an indication of how some of this was done at particular homes. We tried to leave any existing vegetation that was there except for turf grass. We would remove the sod, but any trees or shrubs we would just plant around. Typically we would lay down a landscaping fabric just to control weed growth, because weeding is a real issue if you don't control the weeds. So we would lay down landscaping fabric. We transplant through the fabric. If you go to slide 24, transplant through the fabric. Once the ferns are transplanted, then we would come in and mulch everything between the ferns to cover up the fabric and control the weeds, and found that this was fairly successful as far as getting the ferns to grow and preventing grass and weeds from coming up in between them. On next slide, 25, this was one of the yards we worked at, which was not... the homeowner had some prized azaleas, and they didn't want those azaleas in the process of removing soil. So our goal there at that particular one was to remove the arsenic that was around the base of these azaleas so that they wouldn't have to be cut down in order to remove the soil. A different type of remediation from what we finally or a lot of times are accustomed to. This is another one of those same azaleas on that, or a different azalea on the same property. Again, the goal there was try to remove the arsenic from around the base of the trees and other shrubs. So as I mentioned, late September we come back, we sample, we use a 30-point composite, we collect the plant biomass sample. This is on slide 27. We collect a plant sample. We'll go on to the next slide, slide 28. One of the things that I mentioned is we were trying to improve our sample precision, and we felt like we were at that from our duplicates. As we went to the 30-point composite, we found that in general most all of our duplicates were within 10%. and we felt very comfortable with our duplicates and how they were performing. One thing we did try in 2006 is we tried to do some unplanted controls to see what the when we didn't plant any ferns, when we didn't do anything, in the spring to the fall, if we have no activity on the property. And one of the things we found is that a lot of times our arsenic concentrations increased from the spring to the fall, which was something that we weren't quite able to explain. We'll go on to the next slide. In slide 29, initial work we did in 2006 with this new sampling scheme, we found that we were very successful in still being able to remove arsenic, but because of the tighter numbers, we felt a lot more comfortable in being able to predict or being able to evaluate the performance. And the numbers there became a lot more realistic as far as looking at removal of arsenic from the soil. We eliminated some of these wide swings that we were seeing in some of our earlier years. But there did tend to be some seasonal variation that we have to deal with. If we move on to the next slide, slide number 30, 2007 and 2008 modifications, one of the things we looked at is moving up the planting date. We traditionally tried to plant the ferns. We based it on a frost-free period of May 15th, beginning May 15th, and so we would typically start planting after that. We felt that based on some of the work we'd seen at some of the other properties that we could get away with planting the ferns a little earlier. And even though they don't grow much that first part of May or the end of April because it's too cold, they don't grow, but they'll survive damaging frost, they'll do fine. And it puts a lot less stress on them during the transplanting stage. What we find in Washington, D.C., if you end up transplanting those ferns in that last week of May, many times you'll have very warm temperatures all of a sudden, and you take these ferns that are out of a controlled environment in a greenhouse, they ship them up in a truck, and you're taking them out of a box and putting them out in temperatures that might be 90 degrees. That's a very stressful situation for the plants. So we found that by planting them a little earlier in the season that we could eliminate some of that stress. It made a big difference in their growth later on. They didn't have the transplant shock. Would really do much better, and you gain almost 3 weeks of growing time during the prime part of the year when the plants are really developing roots and removing arsenic. One of the other things we looked at is discontinuing use of shade cloth. Many times these ferns, as you transplant them out into full sun, they are exposed. They tend to do well under partly shaded conditions, so a lot of times we would put up shade cloth to protect them. What we found is by moving up the planting date, we could eliminate the shade cloth because they didn't have that stress early on, and we also had much better growth under those conditions. We found that they were very responsive to certain fertilizer applications, particularly some of the micronutrients that you may not consider. Some of the copper and iron micronutrients were very effective in helping the plants to grow. One of the things we were always concerned about was the phosphorus, balancing our phosphorus, because as you know, phosphate and arsenate are very similar, and you can, in some respects, phosphate will help desorb some of the arsenate from the soil, but if you have too high of phosphate solution, you get competition for uptake. So that's one of the challenges that we had to deal with, is how much phosphate to apply. Typically, we had tried to eliminate phosphate in these residential areas, had residual phosphate from applications to their lawn and garden. You could get away with that, but many of the properties we found were a little bit deficient in phosphate, so we started increasing our phosphate. That was effective. The other thing we did is we moved away from some of the other fern varieties that we were looking at and went strictly with Pteris vittata. Under ideal conditions, Pteris vittata seems to outgrow and outperform the other varieties like the Pteris cretica. If the conditions aren't ideal, sometimes Pteris cretica will do a little bit better. It seems to be a little more tolerant of adverse conditions, a little more tolerant of stress. So there's a little bit of a balance there. If you think you can manage everything optimally, the Pteris vittata definitely seems to grow the best under less ideal conditions than you think about some of the other varieties. So we move on to the next slide, slide number 31. These were ferns that are actually grown. Now, this was from 2007 in this person's yard. You may notice that this is actually grown underneath a pressure-treated deck, which is one of the issues we face here. These are all properties that are done by the Army Corps of Engineers. Is there a question about where the arsenic would be? If you look at the soil concentrations of other elements in this particular soil, you'll notice that it has a fairly high level of chromium and copper. as well as arsenic, which kind of gives you an idea where much of the lumber is pressure-treated wood with copper chromated arsenic. On the other hand, many of the other properties around there are contaminated with arsenic or have elevated arsenic because it was all attributed to that area, the activities that occurred during World War I. Those properties are all treated the same regardless of, there's no attempt to try to identify the source of the arsenic. But these plants in this particular property did very well. These are Pteris vittata ferns that were planted in the 1st of May. This picture was taken probably sometime in August. And they do very well. They produce fronds that are quite large. But under this optimal conditions where you can water them and treat them well, you get very good growth. And this is the kind of growth you need to try to remove that arsenic from the soil. So we move on to the next slide. Slide 32 just shows you another one of the properties. This was a fence line that we've worked on 3 years now, or 4 years. The arsenic basically extends about 3 feet out from either side of the fence along this fence line, and it has some fairly high concentrations of arsenic. But the goal here is that there are some trees along the left-hand side of this picture that are mature trees that the residents were worried about losing if they excavated the soil, and so that's why this particular property was selected. This is another rather challenging property. It was in a backyard on slide number 33, a very shaded area. And that was one of the things is was a little bit too shaded, but we didn't have the option of removing any of the overhead canopy. That all had to stay intact as we were trying to get these. And normally the ferns like a little bit of shade, but this was probably a little bit on the heavy side. But they did okay. It wasn't a bad location for them. If we move to the next slide, slide 34, again, this is a rather unique phytoremediation type of operation in that basically this particular home, we had done a large part of the yard previous to this year. There was still a remaining area of elevated concentrations right around this English boxwood. Didn't want to have removed, and so the idea was to try to preserve that by using those plants around the base of that plant, the base of that shrub, to remove arsenic from the root zone so that they wouldn't have to destroy that. So it's a little bit different type of application. But they're all based on economics, and when you start looking at remediation costs, you have to include the restoration costs, and sometimes the restoration of the existing vegetation costs more than the actual removal of the soil, and that was one of the reasons that phytoremediation was employed there. So if we go to the next slide, slide 35, where we look at our arsenic uptake, and from 2004 to 2008, you can see this is our average uptake. We get some high numbers, some low numbers. 2006 was a poor year. Then we'd had poor growth, poor uptake, and that seems to be we were able to compensate for that in some of the succeeding years. And likewise with biomass yields, these are average biomass yields over all of the plots, comparing the various varieties. I won't take the time to go into them right now. 2006 to 2008 summary. We'll kind of skip through this a little quickly here as far as you can look at that on your own. But you can see some of the differences, some of the things we're able to start to see is some of the trends. But we find that we still have some of the same problems as far as the fluctuations in some of the arsenic numbers as we look at those from 2006 to 2007, 2008. There are some seasonal variations that we have to deal with, but overall, as we look at that from the beginning of 2006 to 2008, we can see those decreases. And this goes back to my point earlier that I made about having things for multiple years, being able to look at things over long term and look at those changes in the soil concentration over a longer period of time than just one season. And slide number 38. Again, shows this is one of the properties that posed a particular challenge that I talked about earlier. The numbers tend to go all over the place. We have some very unexplained events as you look at the soil concentrations. For instance, in plot B, started out in 2006 at 103, went up to 203, back down to 97, and then this year at 152. And these were all with a 30-point composite. This is an anomaly as far as this particular property. We don't see this at all the other properties, but this one we still have a struggle with. And then Site 3 is another one where we have worked there for a number of years. What we're finding is the arsenic concentration tends to level out. And we think here what we probably have removed all of the plant available arsenic and really are not seeing any further decreases at this particular property. So we'll move on to slide 40, just to summarize Spring Valley. I think we've seen some very good results there with some of these properties. We have some properties that have done very well, and we've been able to see very good decreases that have been what we would expect. I've had some other problems where we've had one property where the soil arsenic, there's particulates and things like that in the soil that just prevent us from making any meaningful conclusions from that particular site. And understanding the sample variability is a real challenge. Briefly now, I just want to touch on the another property. This just shows you an innovative approach. This was a property that down in central Virginia. It was a former orchard area, had elevated arsenic. Because working on this particular property, they purchased ferns from us to do the work. Much of this was an excavation operation where they removed the hot spots and then used the ferns to treat some of the smaller areas. Just to show you an innovative approach, there was no electricity or power at this particular site and not really any water that could be used for irrigation. But there was a spring that came out of the side of the hill. And what was done is we put in a solar panel to pump water into a storage tank that then operated a gravity flow drip irrigation system. So rather unique way to address the irrigation issues. And it was a very good environment for fern growth. Even with limited water supply, they seemed to do okay on slide 43. Slide 44 shows some other ferns at a part of that location. And slide 45 is just another part of that property. These were results from 2007. On slide 46, these again were averages over some fairly large areas that I just consolidated the data. We see typically the trends, frond arsenic in the plants is very much corresponds to the soil arsenic. And when you have elevated soil arsenic, you get much higher concentrations in the plants, which was what was observed at that particular property. So just to summarize, I realize I probably went a little bit long on my presentation here, but phytoremediation of arsenic is continuing to develop. I think there's some good solutions still to have another plant besides a fern that accumulated arsenic. But what we found is that really maximizing biomass growth is one of the primary factors to success. The ferns tend to take up arsenic, you know, whether they're small or whether they're big, and so the bigger you grow them, the better performance you'll get. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation.
Thanks very much, Michael. At this time, we can open the floor for questions. I'd like to ask that you take your phone off mute if you have a question and go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, this is Mihai Aldea from Integral Consulting. I was wondering if you attempted to do a sort of a mass balance calculation to try to close the arsenic budget for any of these plots or sites.
We did. In fact, last year in 2007, we tried a very extensive mass balance, and I didn't go into that detail, but we took samples from the top six, and we took different depths. We took root samples, shoot samples. In fact, each grid, instead of taking duplicates, we took four replicate sample 30-point composites from each one of those. Found out is that we could account for a portion of the arsenic on some of the plots. Our mass balance came out really good, and then there were others where we couldn't close it. And we couldn't ever determine why on those particular plots it didn't work. Some places it works and some others it doesn't. But what we found is that at least I think there's a very strong correlation to our sampling depth and the depth of contamination, and controlling your sampling depth is one of the keys to getting a very successful, being able to close that mass balance.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Hello, this is Joe Chai from the Dow Chemical. I have a couple of questions. One is, how deep is the roots can go? The other one is, what concentration level of arsenic will be toxic to the fern? And the third one is, how many seasons are needed to remove the arsenic contamination from the soil? For example, if you have a 100 ppm or 200 ppm concentration in soil.
Okay, the first question is the depth. We typically find these roots when we grow these plants as an annual. We'll find that the roots are most effective in the top 12 inches, say 12 to 15. Once you get below about 15 inches, the root density goes down quite a bit. Some of that depends on the soil compaction and so forth, what the soil profile is like. Certainly the top 12 inches are where they're most effective. As far as the concentrations that are toxic to the ferns, until you get soil concentrations that are up in 1,000, 600 to 1,000 parts per million, I haven't really seen any toxicity in these ferns. They'll tolerate very high concentrations in the fronds. Any property where it would be toxic to the ferns is probably not a candidate for phytoremediation just because there's too much arsenic there to remove. Removal rates, we kind of baseline a removal rate of somewhere around, on average, 10 parts per million per year. Now, that doesn't mean it won't be more than that. We've seen removal rates higher and we've seen them lower, but that's kind of where we target our concentrations. And so that's an average concentration. So that says if I've got a soil that's 100 parts per million and I've got to get it down to 10, well, that may not be a good candidate for phytoremediation if the entire property's at 100. What we find, though, is that many properties, if the target is 20 parts per million, much of the property might be at 30 or 40, which then makes it a good candidate, and you have some hot spots that you have to deal with in another way, if they're much higher than that. So really you're looking at 10 parts per million per year on average is about what you want to use to try to gauge how well it will work, with the understanding that you get a lot of variation in your soil and some areas will be higher, some will be lower.
Okay, thank you very much.
Michael, this is Heather. I'd like to ask a couple of questions that have come in from online participants. We've gotten quite a few questions, and I'm going to give you just a few points submitted by a few different people. If you could comment on relationship between soil moisture and optimum fern growth and how you manage shade and other variabilities in the growth quality to optimize for plant growth. I'm sorry, environmental parameters to optimize for plant growth.
Okay. Soil moisture, what we would do is we put in tensiometers in the plot. What we found is these ferns do well under, they want to be kept moist. They don't like to be waterlogged by any means. They don't tolerate really wetland conditions. But a regular irrigation is critical if you want to maximize their growth. They'll grow, without it, but if you really are trying to remediate and get maximum growth, we would put in an irrigation cycle every 3 to 4 days, depending on the precipitation, on how much rainfall we had. But we tried to keep the soil above 80% field capacity. That was our goal, to keep their growth where we wanted them to be. The other environmental factors, sometimes you can manage and sometimes you can't. Shade, typically with full exposure to sun, and if we felt like the ferns were looking a little stressed, we put up shade cloth. Sometimes that's very easy. It's just a matter of putting stakes, a 2-foot stake in the ground, and you can lay the shade cloth right over those stakes, spread those stakes out to keep the shade cloth up above the plant canopy. And then once the plants have become somewhat adapted, you find that you can remove that shade cloth, or we've left it on all year as well. So there's some things like that you can do to manage that. But we found in many properties, if we get the ferns in growing and get them healthy before it gets too warm, that they'll do fine without the shade cloth.
Thanks. And here's another question from internet participants. This is from Michael Sills of the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. He wanted to know, what are the actual disposal methods and costs used for harvested crops? Solid waste landfill, hazardous waste landfill, or incinerator? What are the different choices? And whether or not leaching studies have been done on the harvested ferns to see if there's desorption of arsenic?
Yeah, we have looked at that. what we typically find is that most of the areas where we've used our ferns, the amount of material that you end up with is not enough to really worry a lot about the disposal costs. Typically, we run a TCLP on the plant material, and we find out that if they've accumulated any, you know, if they've done anything as far as removing arsenic, they will fail TCLP and have to be disposed of as hazardous waste. And normally, we've boxed them up or drummed them up and had that done, just because the amount of material is not worth trying to do anything more than that. The cost of trying to figure out how to deal with it is really not that big of a deal for these types of volumes. If you're starting to look at large areas, though, we have done some studies. We did some early on where you can extract the arsenic. Over 85% of the arsenic is leachable out of the plant tissue. And so you can leach it out and extract it out. We've run it through a press and pressed it out that way and have the biomass that's left then is non-hazardous, and you have a liquid waste versus a solid waste. We haven't done that on any of our sites because we just haven't felt it was justified, but there are options there that you can look at depending on the volume that you need to deal with.
Great. That's good information there. Yvette Lowney of Exponent from Boulder, Colorado, also had some questions from that she submitted over the Internet. Have you seen differences in success based on soil type or arsenic source? Arsenic in some soils can be very stable or insoluble. And are those the forms that are recalcitrant to phytoremediation? And then kind of related to what you've been talking about already, have you identified any measures that are predictive of how well phytoremediation will work for a particular soil? For example, if there's a correlation between plant uptake and TCLP, SPLP, or other leaching processes, or the correlation between plant uptake and soil characteristics such as iron or manganese. And I'm sorry, that's a lot of questions
yeah.
all at once.
No, I understand. I understand where it's coming from.
Okay.
And those are very important questions, because I think that's absolutely correct, is that there are just a lot of factors that influence the ability of the ferns to remove arsenic from the soil. And that is one of the things you want to establish before you go into it, is what form is my arsenic, and is it in a residual or recalcitrant form that the plants cannot accumulate? Because if it is, you know, you're wasting your time by trying to put the plants out there. And we've seen that on some of these properties where even though the total arsenic in the soil was fairly low and right in that range, we're finding that it's bound up in a form that we can't get it. And you grow the plants and they do well, you know, they're growing well, but they're not accumulating the arsenic, and you look and you try to extract that arsenic from the soil, and you find out that most of that arsenic is what you would call in a residual phase if you did a sequential extraction. That arsenic is bound up in the iron oxides in a form that it's not extractable. And so that's one of the things we've looked at, is sequential extraction. It's a little tricky. It's not quite as straightforward as with some of the cations, because we find that arsenic is tied up with a lot of times with iron oxides, and it depends on the kind of iron oxide you have. You know, is it a crystalline oxide and the arsenic is occluded, or is it just is it an amorphous iron oxide, then which the arsenate's much more available. So we've done the sequential extractions, and what you find, it's a little tricky there, is because as you remove iron oxides, you have to reduce the iron oxides to extract them, and that ends up precipitating out some of your arsenic sometimes. But some of the methods that are used to predict phosphate availability, you can use some of the Bray phosphate tests, give you an indication of the arsenate availability, because those two chemistries are very similar. And so we've started using that a little bit more than a sequential extraction. But there are differences with soil type, and I think most of it deals with the iron oxide content. We do find differences in availability based on source. Pesticide sources of arsenic seem to be much more available than CCA sources. CCA sources, I won't say they're not available, but they don't tend to be as soluble as what the pesticide sources are.
Great job. Those are a lot of questions. Are there any more questions from our phone participants? Okay, I'll just ask one more question since it's very much related to the arsenic and kind of follows on what you were talking about. Have you used XRF specifically? This question comes from Michael Adam of Osready.
We have not, just because we don't own one. We've had partners that have done the XRF work while we've been out there, and we've collected samples and done correlations, and I know the XRF technology has improved greatly. And the XRF correlations with a 30-50 method are much better now than they used to be, particularly if you dry the sample and sieve it, you get very good repeatability that way. In-field, in-situ measurements, XRF are subject to some problems because of the moisture content of the soil, and so you have to be able to do that moisture correction and establish what that correction factor is. But as far as, you know, it used to be the XRF wasn't good down below, you know, 50 parts per million, but I think now some of the new algorithms and the technology has improved to where they're feeling more comfortable with those at the lower levels.
Great, thanks. There were a few other questions that were submitted and are more general in nature, and I just want to encourage people to continue to submit questions. We'll have a chance to allow both of our speakers to answer questions towards the end of the seminar. So at this time, I will go ahead and thank Dr. Blaylock and move on to our second speaker, who is Dr. Raina Mayer. She's a professor of environmental biology at the University of Arizona, where she serves as the associate director of the University of Arizona Superfund Basic Research Program. Dr. Mayer's research is interdisciplinary and is focused on developing a fundamental understanding of the biological factors and processes that influence the transport and fate of both microorganisms and chemical contaminants in the environment. The information gained from this work, from this research, is used in the development of innovative remediation technologies. Dr. Mayer has opened as the lead author of the widely used textbook Environmental Microbiology. Dr. Mayer received her undergraduate degree in biology and chemistry from the University of Minnesota, her PhD in microbiology from Rutgers, and her postdoc in biochemistry at Iowa State University. And the title of her talk is Phytostabilization of Mine Tailings in Arid and Semi-Arid Environments. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Mayer.
Well, thank you very much. And let me begin by thanking the NIEHS organizers, especially Justin Crane and Heather Henry, and also Dr. Blaylock for giving a great introduction to phytoremediation. However, this talk is going to move from the temperate East Coast into the much more arid, semi-arid western United States. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about phytostabilization of mine tailings specifically in arid and semi-arid environments, because there are some particular problems associated with those types of environments. And the picture that you see on slide 48 is a good example of this type of environment. As you can see, it's characterized in the foreground by fairly sparse vegetation. In the background, you can see some taller green trees, and these are growing right along the riparian corridor of the San Pedro River, where there is a little more water. Please go to slide 49. Mine tailings are an extensive and global problem, and it's illustrated by the pictures in this slide. They show really well different types of water erosion, and also in the upper right-hand corner, the formation of acid leachates. The bottom left-hand corner shows one big problem, which is mine tailings stability, especially if the mine tailings is adjacent to a community. If due to erosional processes, these mine tailings collapse, they can actually impact the community. Go to slide number 50. So I would like to focus this talk on arid and semi-arid environments, and the issues for tailings in these environments are quite different than for temperate climates. In temperate climates, acid leachates are one of the major problems. However, in arid and semi-arid environments, wind erosion and water erosion, as shown in the pictures on the right, are the major problems. And so you can see in the upper right-hand picture This is a mine tailing site in Mexico, and it's a windy day, and you can see these tailings are blowing right over the community. These tailings contain up to 6% by weight of lead. The bottom picture shows the San Pedro River and the tailings right adjacent to the river. Right now, the river is at a low point, but during the summer monsoon seasons, the water levels rise and actually cut these tailings right into the river and carry them downstream. And so through wind erosion and water erosion, you get environmental contamination. And the middle picture on the left is a good example of human exposure. These children are playing in a pool of water that's downstream from the tailings in the upper right-hand picture. And the water in this pool has elevated levels of arsenic. And again, the children use this for recreation. So in arid and semi-arid environments, exposure routes are primarily through inhalation of tailings particles, also through ingestion of contaminated water, and in small children, through ingestion of soil that is contaminated through aerosols with mine tailing particles. So if you look at mine tailings materials, what are their characteristics in arid and semi-arid environments? In terms of metals and pH, we actually find a large range. Historic tailings sites tend to have very high metal concentrations, whereas modern tailings sites have very little metal in because extraction processes have become much better. In terms of pH, we see a range from very, very acid tailings to neutral to alkaline tailings, and these tailings generally have high carbonate concentrations that give great buffering capacity to the generation of acid. So again, metals and pH can vary quite a bit. But on the other hand, these tailings are all characterized by a lack of soil structure and a lack of water holding capacity. They have highly impacted microbial communities. And by that, I mean if you look at neutrophilic heterotrophic bacteria, and these are the bacteria that do nutrient cycling and carbon cycling, these are the good guys, they are very, very low in numbers in these tailings. But if you look at iron and sulfur oxidizers, and these are the bacteria that create acid conditions, so they're the bad actors, they have highly elevated numbers. In addition, these sites have very limited vegetation, and in many cases remain barren for decades. Go to slide 51. And so we are looking at a process called phytostabilization. And while Dr. Blaylock is looking at removal or phytoextraction of metals into shoot tissues, in phytostabilization, we want the metals to stay in the rooting zone and to become more stable and not be plant bioavailable and not be leachable. And so as shown in this picture, When you add compost amendment or some kind of organic amendment to try and get plants to grow in these materials, you immediately start complexing metals. In addition, plants produce root exudates that complex metals, and the bacterial and microbial community produces exudates that complex metals. And over time, this complexation becomes a precipitation and even incorporation into minerals that are forming that have very, very reduced bioavailability. So that's the theory behind phytostabilization. Benefits include an aesthetic vegetative cap. It's an economic approach. It reduces metal exposure. And the jury is still out on long-term stabilization, self-sustainability, and ecological succession, because most of the studies that have been done over 1 to 2 years and then are no longer followed. And so we really need some good long-term studies, 10 to 20 years in length, to look at some of these other aspects. There are three major challenges in phytostabilization. And these include plant selection, the amendments that you add, and how do you evaluate the success or failure of a phytostabilization? So go to slide 52. So I'm going to talk about each one of these challenges in turn, and starting with plant selection criteria. For arid and semi-arid environments, you want drought and salt-tolerant plants because those are the characteristics of tailings found in these environments. You need hardy pioneer species. You want perennial species that come back year after year. In general, we have looked at some halophytes, and two of them are shown here, Atroplex canescens and Atroplex lentiformis. These are both halophytes, and while these plants accumulate salts into shoot tissues, they don't accumulate toxic metals, so they seem to work pretty well. In addition, I've put a picture of a mesquite tree there just to show that you can also use plants that actually add nutrients back to the soil. This is a nitrogen-fixing plant. Go to slide 53. It's pretty well agreed that the way to go in selecting plants is to look at native plants, to do a plant survey in the area that you're interested in remediating. And we actually did this for an area near Tucson, Arizona, in southern Arizona. And we looked at 15 different native plants and assayed them in mine tailings and found that about 8 of them were actually able to survive. And so these would be candidates for a phytoremediation trial. Go to slide 54. We need for these plants to be able to tolerate metals, so they have to be metallophytes. But we do not want them, unlike the ferns that you heard about earlier, we do not want them to accumulate metals in shoot tissues. And so you can look at this quantitatively by determining a bioconcentration factor, which is the total metal in the shoot over the total metal in the mine tailings, or a translocation factor, which is the total metal in the shoot over the total metal in the root. Both of these accumulation factors should be much less than 1 for a plant to be effective in phytostabilization. Other things of concern include the amount of metal in the soil, because there are toxicity limits to plants. Those are the SPLs. Also, determining plant leaf tissue toxicity limits, and also looking at domestic animal toxicity limits. And so you don't want the plant to accumulate metals. If you're phytostabilizing and you're going to leave the vegetative cap in place, you don't want plants to accumulate levels that will be toxic to foraging or domestic animals like cows. Go to slide 55. The last plant selection criterion is that you should look at different functional groups. You need to have perennials, but there should be a mix of grasses, shrubs, and trees because they have different water uses from upper and lower layers. They have different types of rooting. They have different types of canopy development, and they have different metal tolerances, nutrient uses as well. Now, remember, the goals are to reduce wind and water erosion, and I pulled the figure on the right from extension guide from the University of Nebraska. And what this shows is that you don't need complete plant cover to significantly reduce soil loss from erosion processes. And so that's a good thing for phytostabilization of mine tailings, because mine tailings, like the previous talk you heard, are very heterogeneous, and there will likely be spots that are amenable or more or less amenable to vegetation, and it's going to be difficult to achieve a complete smooth cap over any particular site. Go to slide 56. So the second challenge is, what amendments are you going to add in order to get plants to grow? As I said, mine tailing sites remain barren for decades after they're deposited in arid and semi-arid environments. So you cannot just put a transplant on or put seeds in a site and expect them to grow. You need to add amendments, and this is the really large cost of this remediation. What amendments do you add, and how much do you need to add? Generally, we are in our research, we've been looking at organic amendments. You can use either biosolids or compost. The immediate impact of an organic amendment is to increase pH of acidic mine tailings, to improve the physical structure, to provide a slow-release nutrient source, and to provide an immediate complexation of toxic metals. If you compare biosolids and compost, biosolids are less weathered material and don't last as long, and so our research has focused on the use of compost amendments. Also, we find that site managers prefer compost in many cases, especially if the site is near a community or is in an environmentally sensitive area. You can also look at adding inorganic amendments, including fertilizers and lime, but again, these have much shorter-term effects, and reapplication, multiple reapplication may be necessary. So again, you have to look at all of this with cost in mind. Go to slide 57. And the last challenge, then, is how do you evaluate the success or failure of your phytostabilization? And we look at plant criteria, microbial criteria, and soil criteria. For plant criteria, we look at biomass and percent cover. We look at whether these plants are self-propagating. Do they allow native colonizers to move in? Do the plant shoot metal concentrations? Are they less than the domestic animal toxicity limits? And do plants survive, and are they productive over a long period of time? For microbial criteria, we look to see whether there are increased neutrophilic heterotrophic counts, those are the good guys, and whether there are decreased autotrophic iron and sulfur oxidizers. We also, in general, look for increased diversity and activity, which generally indicates better health. For soil criteria, we look at improved soil aggregation. We look at for reduced erosion and runoff, and we look for decreased metal bioavailability and mobility. Go to slide 58. So I'm going to talk about two examples that we've looked at the University of Arizona, and I call these sort of the stress extremes of mine tailings. The first is the more stressed site, the Klondike site. This site is adjacent to Aravaipa Creek. It was a lead and zinc operation in the 1950s. Excuse me. It is highly acidic, although it's very heterogeneous and ranges from about pH 2 to 7. It has elevated lead and zinc up to 20 grams per kilogram, and arsenic, cadmium, and copper are also elevated. The less stressed site is the Boston Mill site. This is adjacent to the San Pedro River. It was a silver and gold ore processing operation in the 1880s. It is alkaline, pH 8 to 9, and it also contains high levels of lead, you can see 16, manganese 50, and zinc 8 grams per kilogram. Slide 59. So because of the stress extremes of these two materials, we did a greenhouse study on the Klondike material, and this was with Atroplex lentiformis. It was a three-month study where we looked at the compost amendment required to establish plants on two types of tailings from the site, one with pH about 3 and one with pH about 6. We compared this to an off-site control soil. For the Boston Mill site, you can actually see plants starting to encroach on these tailings, whereas the Klondike site, it is completely barren. So we thought we could go right into the field with this study, and we used Atroplex conescens. It was an 18-month study, and we compared plants that either, transplants in this case, that either had compost amendment or did not. go to slide 60. So these are the results of the two studies. For the Klondike, we found that a minimum of 10 to 15% compost by weight is required. That's actually a lot of compost. And you can see in the picture on the right, the 15% compost amended tailings have plants about the same size as the control soil. 10% compost amended tailings looks a little bit stunted. 5% compost is severely stunted, and there was no growth in the one that was tailings alone. If you look at the microbial data, the iron and sulfur oxidizers initially in the tailings were 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 counts per gram. They showed a decrease of 1 to 5 logs over this study, over the course of this study, with the highest decrease associated with the highest compost amendment. On the other hand, the neutrophilic heterotrophic bacteria, the good guys, were initially 10 counts per gram in the pH 3 material, 75 counts per gram in the pH 6 material, and this increased by 3 to 5 logs during the course of the study. And again, the largest increase was associated with the highest compost amendment. Compost amendment had an immediate increase on these tailings in terms of increasing pH, increasing the organic carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus presence. So then we can compare these results with the Boston Mill results, and there we found 80% of the transplants survived in the site. The plant volume increased more than 30-fold, so you got a nice-looking shrub after 18 months. And there was no effect of compost. So the plants with and without compost survived and grew equally well. In terms of microbial data, the initial counts were much, much higher than Klondike, 2 times 10 to the 5th counts per gram. And over the course of this study, neutrophilic heterotrophs increased by 1 to 2 logs, again, indicating better health of the planted plots. We also did an interesting analysis where we took soil samples from the rhizosphere of the plants and also from plots which were unplanted, and we did a microbial fingerprint analysis. And what we found is that the fingerprints of the soil community from planted treatments were very similar to each other, but were statistically different from the soil community that was found in the unplanted control. Go to slide 61. So if we back up and ask simply, were the plants that we chose for these two studies good? Do they have good phytostabilization potential? For the Klondike, our answer is yes. We found that the quail bush was metal tolerant. It primarily root concentrated toxic metals, and the only shoot accumulation we saw was for salts and a little bit for zinc. For the Boston Mill, interestingly enough, even though four-winged saltbush is a cousin to quail bush, we saw that the lead levels in shoot tissues were up to threefold higher than domestic animal toxicity limits. So that was very interesting to us, that you could have two very closely related plants, but one seems to accumulate lead more than the other, and so we would say that the phytostabilization potential of quail bush is better than four-winged saltbush. Go to slide 62. So the wide difference in compost amendment required for plant establishment in the Klondike and the Boston Mill tailings led us to explore two other tailings, which we considered as having stress levels somewhere in between the Klondike and the Boston Mill. And so all of those are shown on slide 62. So what we see here is that the Klondike and Boston Mill on the left required 10 to 15% compost or no compost. And the Nakazari tailings, which are acidic but have low metal content, require 5 to 10% compost. And then another tailings, which is also from southern Arizona, which is neutral and low in metal content, also required 5 to 10% compost. So we would have predicted that the tailings in the brown box from southern Arizona, which are neutral and have low metal content, would also have required less compost. And that sort of tells us that you cannot simply look at metal content and pH when you're evaluating phytostabilization potential of tailings. You have to look beyond that. And so one thing I started to look at was total organic carbon, and that helps, and also total nitrogen, and that helps tell the story here. If you look at the Klondike, Nakazari, and southern Arizona tailings, they all have very, very low levels of organic carbon and nitrogen, whereas the Boston Mill, which did not require compost, has significantly higher levels of organic carbon and nitrogen. Go to slide 63. So the realization that phytostabilization potential is dependent on more than pH and metal content has led us to explore the microbial community in the tailings more deeply. And so this slide shows a complex diversity analysis on the Klondike tailings, a pH 3 sample, a pH 6 sample, and the offsite control. And I'd like to direct your attention to the numbers in the center of each pie chart. The pH 3 tailings, it's 4, pH 6 is 7, and the offsite control sample is 11. And what these numbers represent are the colored triangles, which represent major divisions of bacteria. And so you can see that diversity decreases as you move from the control soil to the pH 6 tailings to the pH 3 tailings. And another analysis you can do on this is to look at the ratio of heterotrophic bacteria to autotrophic bacteria, good guys to bad guys. And for the offsite control soil, that ratio is 9.5, almost 10. And the majority of these bacteria that were in the soil are obligately heterotrophic. If you look at the ratio in the pH 6 tailings, it is reduced to 3, and only 25% of these organisms are obligately heterotrophic. And finally, if you look at the pH 3 tailings, the heterotrophic to autotrophic ratio is reduced further to 1.7, and none of them are obligately heterotrophic. And in fact, most of the organisms that we identified in the pH 3 and pH 6 tailings are iron and sulfur oxidizers. Go to page 64. So we don't expect practitioners in the field to do such a complex diversity analysis. It takes a lot of time and gives you probably too much information. But I do believe that a simple neutrophilic heterotrophic plate count may be enough for a practitioner to get a good idea of the level of stress in a particular mine tailing site and relate that to phytostabilization potential and to what amount of amendments, which are the costly part of this process, will be required to remediate the site. So in the white box on the right, we looked at heterotrophic neutrophilic counts, or I'm comparing heterotrophic neutrophilic counts for the pH 3 sample, which are 10 counts per gram, the pH 6 sample, which are 75 counts per gram, and the offsite control soil, which is increased to 8 times 10 to the 4 counts per gram. Go to slide 65. And in fact, you can look at the neutrophilic heterotrophic counts for the 4 tailings that we've worked with. And if we look at the Boston Mill, which requires no compost, it starts out with a healthy heterotrophic population of 2 times 10 to the 5. If you go to the southern Arizona tailings in the brown box, which requires 5 to 10% compost, they have about 8 times 10 to the 3 counts per gram. if you look at the Nakazari tailings that also require 5 to 10% compost, they have a little less than 100 counts per gram. And then if you look at the Klondike, which is the most stressed of these tailings and requires 10 to 15% compost, if you'll recall, the very acidic tailings had 10 counts per gram, and the pH 6 tailings had 75 counts per gram. And so we think there is a correlation then between this simple heterotrophic plate count that can either be done by the practitioner or sent out to a lab to do. There's a correlation between those results and how severely impacted the tailing site is. Go to slide 66. The final point I'd like to make is that we have been looking at whether you can help plants establish in and grow on mine tailings using specific plant growth promoting microorganisms. And I've summarized some results in this slide. On the left-hand side for bacterial plant growth promoting isolates, the two graphs show the top is root biomass and the bottom is shoot biomass. The first bar on the left is the control, which does not have a plant growth promoting isolate, but it does have compost and Klondike tailings. And then the four bars on the right are four individual plant growth promoting bacteria, and you can see in each case, if we inoculated the seeds of the plant with these bacteria, we got substantial increases in plant biomass. And in fact, we find that with these plant growth promoting bacteria, you can establish plants in the tailings at the low end of the compost range that I've been giving you, 5 to 10%, meaning 5%, with increased plant biomass. We've also looked at encapsulating these plant growth promoting bacteria into alginate. So if you look at the picture with two test tubes, basically we grow up these organisms, mix them with alginate, and then dehydrate them. We can store these alginate encapsulated inocula for over a year and then inoculate seeds with them, and they work just fine. So this is actually a way that you could commercialize this technology. And then on the right, I'm just showing we get similar results, increased plant biomass production using mycorrhizal fungi as the plant growth promoting microorganism. Go to slide 67. This slide is to show you that I think the reason that these plant growth promoting organisms work is that they have a direct influence on the development of the microbial community that's in association with the plant as it grows and develops. And so what we did in this study, again, is to take soil samples and do microbial community fingerprints and then statistically compare those fingerprints. And what this data shows is that if you look at the fingerprint in the yellow circles, those come from the compost alone. So that's the compost microbial community that's given to the tailings when you mix the compost with the community. The control in the orange circles are plants that were amended or tailings that were amended with compost but not inoculated with the microorganism. And you can see that the microbial community is very similar to the compost community. So the compost community probably is the major contributor to the microbial community for those plants. And then you can look at the other colored circles, the green circles, the purple circles, and the blue circles. Those represent three different plant growth promoting bacteria, and you can see that the microbial communities from the plants that they were used to inoculate are significantly different than the plants that did not have that were not inoculated. And not only are those microbial communities completely different, the result is that you can use a lower compost amendment and that you can get better plant growth with these optimized microbial communities. Go to slide 68. So in conclusion, we believe that phytostabilization has excellent potential as a cost-effective remediation strategy for mine tailings in arid and semi-arid environments. There are still some major information gaps. We need to know whether these vegetative caps are viable over the long term. We need to know whether this is a technology that can eventually be self-sustaining so that you didn't have to put no more inputs into it. We need to know whether normal successional plant processes take place after you establish a vegetative cover. And if they do, does metal uptake occur into the shoot material of these new plants? What we hope is that the process of stabilizing metals by the pioneer species that don't shoot accumulate, we hope that process is fast enough that by the time successional plants come in, the metals have very, very decreased plant bioavailability. Another information gap is whether tailings actually transition into something resembling sort of a normal healthy soil. And further, does the speciations of metals in the tailings, in the rhizosphere, change in either the short or long term in any way that we have to be concerned about? In other words, do those changes increase or decrease metal mobility and bioavailability? Go to slide 69. And so I would like to wrap up the talk now by acknowledging my colleagues and students that have worked on this project. And I would also like to say that there are a number of publications from this work, and if anybody is interested in those publications, please send me an email, and I will email them to you. So thank you for listening.
Thank you, Raina. That was a very enjoyable presentation. At this time, let me open the phones for any questions. If you'd like to ask a question to Dr. Mayer, please take the phone off mute, state your name and your organization, and ask your question.
This is Carl Dupol from Green Building Solutions and Supplies. What is your email, Dr. Mayer?
Oh, it's rmayer, M-A-I-E-R, at ag, A-G, short for agriculture, dot Arizona, spelled out, dot edu. And I believe it's also on the website.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Presentation.
Thank you.
You have to have a lot of patience in arid environments because all the processes are slower.
Yes, that's really true, and it's so different than a temperate environment. And I learned that. I actually did my graduate studies on the East Coast, so I had to relearn everything when I came to Arizona.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Well, Raina, you did get a few questions from our internet participants, so I'll ask you. In fact, I believe Carl DePold from Green Building Solutions and Supplies, the person you just spoke to, mm-hmm. also submitted some questions, and I'll ask you about that. He asked if you would elaborate on the biodiversity for plant and soil health compared to monocultures.
Okay, so a monoculture in the long term is much less stable than if you can increase diversity for a number of reasons. Monoculture just doesn't have the different functional groups, including rooting zone depths, including water use from different zones, including canopy development. And so it's much better if you can increase diversity in terms of longevity of a site.
Great. And a follow-up question. Using compost in an arid area can present problems keeping it moist for plant growth and preventing migration by wind. So what are some of the approaches used to manage moisture and reduce wind migration off-site?
Yeah. So we generally till the compost into the tailings. And you do, in an arid environment, especially if you want to get immediate ex- success for a vegetative cover, you do have to irrigate, especially for the first year or so. We have done a site that was a, what I would call a less stressed tailings, where we did not irrigate. And there, if you actually construct the site in such a way that it can catch the rainwater, you can actually get, and you plant your seeds at the right time of the year, in other words, right before the rainy season, you can actually establish plants on these sites without additional water. So I tell you what, wind erosion on these sites is a problem whether or not you put compost on the sites. And you need to have compost on the site in order to establish plants. Water, depending on its availability, is a good thing to have, but it's problematic in arid and semi-arid environments. And so you can, again, manage the site in a way to try and harvest or catch as much of the rainwater and utilize it as possible.
And down in the southwest, most of your rain comes at one time, pretty right?
It actually comes at two times. We get the rainy season in the summer, which is in July and August, and then we have another rainy season in January, December, January.
And I invite you to join the Soil and Water Conservation Society work. Go under swcs.org and sign on. There's a lot of water and soil conservation people who would love to have some information.
Ah, okay. Maybe you could send me some information on that.
I sent it on email too.
Okay.
Are there any other questions from the phone participants? Okay, the internet participants are much less shy. we have another question that kind of follows on, and you're talking about compost.
Mm-hmm.
This one's from Michael Sills, the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services, asking, now the amendments that you mentioned were characterized as biosolids and compost.
Mm-hmm.
So he wanted to know more specifically what type of biosolids were used. Was it a primary sludge, a secondary sludge? Was it septage? Or maybe
it was a secondary sludge.
Secondary sludge.
Yes.
And then what type of compost was used? Is that a biosolid, solid waste, manure?
No. The compost, you can use almost any type of compost that you want. In some of these sites, especially the smaller ones, you can actually go locally and try and get compost from the area. In our studies, our greenhouse studies, we're actually using compost that's made at the University of Arizona Experiment Station, and it's a mixture of green dry waste and cow manure. So compost can range and be many, many different things, and I think you can take advantage of whatever is available in the area.
And the last part of the question was there a fertilizer value to any of those?
That's a great question. And yes, there was, and I can't, it's in our papers, but I can't remember what they are. But yes.
And you were going to leave a citation for us on the additional resources so people can reference your article and find some more details about that.
I can actually give you the citations, yes.
Okay, great.
And you can post them on the web. And then if somebody, I can't give you the PDFs, but if somebody writes to me, I can actually send them the entire paper.
Any more questions from our phone participants? Please take your phone off mute, state your name and your organization, and ask your question. Well, Raina, I had a question for you. So the question I had, the previous talk, site variability was a real issue, and it kind of impacted your ability, the ability to make an assessment about what was happening on the site and the degree of remediation. So on your site, is there much variability with these mine tailings? And that's kind of the first part of the question. The second part of the question is the microbial community. was there a lot of variability from sample to sample, and, you know, about what distance apart or what frequency were you sampling for microbial community?
Yes, there is much site variability on these tailings piles, and in fact, you can go and make site maps with regard to pH, and you can make site maps with regard to individual metal concentrations like lead and zinc. And you can find hot spots, just as Dr. Blalock explained. In terms of the microbial community, I'm trying to think. In terms of counts, we don't see that great a variability. The Klondike site is so stressed that everything was below 100 counts per gram. And it just tells us that the entire site is very stressed. In the Boston Mill site, I was amazed at how close the bacterial fingerprints were for all of the planted zones, and how different that was from the unplanted zones. So I would say that while there is heterogeneity in the microbial community as well, I would say that the heterogeneity signified by the microbial community within a site might not reflect the chemical heterogeneity that's there. Might be less heterogeneous than the chemical variables.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, I'll open the floor to questions for either of our presenters, or both of our presenters, if you would like for them to both take a stab at your question. Again, just take your phone off mute, state your name and your organization, and ask your question.
This is Natina Kosick with AMEC. And I just want to say the presentation was fantastic, and that it's great to see other ways besides remediation to remove soil or anything like that in those areas, and by using plants instead of having costs associated with removal.
Yeah, we both agree with you.
Well, that was one of the big things we did in Spring Valley is that particular site's different in that the remediation costs were, the reason for using plants was not based on cost necessarily. I mean, part of it was, but part of it was preserve existing vegetation and landscaping that was in some cases not replaceable. So it made a little bit different approach. It's been kind of interesting.
Yeah, and let me say that to give you an idea of the size of some of these mine tailing sites, they range anywhere from, less than an acre to one of the sites we're working on is 1,800 acres in size. And it's just not possible to remove all of that material.
Thanks for that question. Are there any others?
Hello, this is Joe Chai from Dow Chemical, and the question is for Dr. Meyer. What is the response or attitude from the regulatory agencies? Are they very successful to accept these approaches, or are they kind of reluctant?
They're very, very interested in these approaches. As a cost-effective way to mitigate the wind erosion, in particular wind erosion of these tailings. Because in the West, what we're seeing with the huge increase in population growth, we're seeing communities encroaching on both modern and historic tailing sites. And so once these communities are built, on a windy day, they're starting to get dust blowing in from these sites, and are very anxious to do something about that. And establishing a vegetative cap is a really good way to reduce wind erosion of dust. So We work closely with EPA Region 9 here in the West, and they are actually very excited about some of the field trials that we have done and are planning to do.
I have a question from one of the online participants that I think is pertinent to both of you. This is from Jennifer Carley from MDNR in Missouri. And regarding toxicity to animals, has bioaccumulation of metals in foraging animals, especially animals raised for human consumption such as cattle, has this been studied or considered?
Yes, absolutely. It's been considered, and there is literature on domestic animal toxicity limits, and so there is literature published by the U.S. Department of Agriculture where you can go and look at what is the allowable level of any particular metal in shoot tissue for grazing animals. So it's absolutely been looked at.
I think one of the things to remember on that's a little different with remediation is when we think a lot of times of grazing animals, we think of them over larger areas, and certainly if you're doing remediation of mine spoils and those types of things where you have these large areas, the metal concentration is much more, you're much more sensitive to the metal concentration than when you're doing a targeted remediation on a smaller area. We had done some studies number of years ago looking at, for instance, remediation of a one-acre site and what the impact would be on animals and that sort of thing based on certain metal concentrations in the plant. And one of the things that came out of it was that while the individual plants may have high levels, it becomes a function of how often or how long that animal spends grazing in that particular area. And so it becomes a function of how big your site is. And for smaller sites, the amount of time that the animal would spend on that, the exposure is actually a lot lower than you would think it would. Now, as the size of the site goes up, then that exposure increases because there's a lot more material to graze and that sort of thing. So it becomes somewhat a product of the amount of area and the time that the animal spends on there, not just the concentration in the plant.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and let me add only that in arid environments, since if you're watering your site, your plants are growing much better than those off-site, and so you probably exacerbate, even in a smaller area, you exacerbate foraging on the site because you're producing nice green growth.
One of the questions we've had in the residential areas we're working, people are concerned about dogs and that sort of thing. Well, what happens if they eat the fern plant that has arsenic in it? And that's something that you'd want to avoid, in any case. But the other thing that I have to remind people is that most people have very toxic plants growing around their house anyway. You know, that some of the plants that we grow in our house and ornamentals and things like that are extremely toxic. And so that's something to consider is that when you create an environment like Raina said, you create an environment with an unusual growth pattern, you're going to invite animals in to eat those, so to speak. Much like if we grow ferns that aren't used to being there, maybe animals would be more likely to ingest them. But typically, many of the plants that are growing on some of these sites are extremely toxic as they are.
Yeah, a lot of your plants they get medications from, right?
Yeah.
Right.
The other thing, has there been any attempt to look at plants that grow along roadsides for phytoremediation capabilities? Because they seem to take up a lot of material from the roadside traffic and everything, spills.
Well, I think there's potential there. Obviously, you look at some of the plants, and that's how we find a lot of these things, is you find something that's growing in an unusual environment. You say, well, why is it thriving, or why is it behaving that way? And these particular fern plants, when they were, when Dr. Ma reported on it, she was surveying, vegetation on arsenic-contaminated sites and came across one that has this really high concentration. The challenge with some of those plants is getting them to respond under cultivation. And we find that even with these ferns, is they're not really domesticated. We're trying to domesticate them, but you know, some of these plants, you know, you start finding, and we did some work with kochia and even some of the Atroplex species. Yeah, they grow, you look at them and they're growing, and then you try to grow them under controlled conditions and get them to respond to plant spacing and fertilize, and they don't seem to do so well then. They really like to thrive in as a weed, and not when you try to domesticate them, they tend to not do quite as well as they did as a weed. So there's some of that that you have to do, but looking at some of these populations that are growing on these sites is an excellent source for germplasm or material to begin your evaluations.
And I guess you want to stick with the native species as opposed to the invasives, right?
Yes. And that's really important in the West as well. And the two mining sites that I gave the examples from are on the two important riparian areas in southern Arizona. And so the site managers are very, very concerned about introducing non-native species.
Yeah, regarding soil minerals, there's a company that does research in Reno, Nevada. You ever hear of BioGreen USA?
No.
Website's biogreenusa.com. They're doing a lot of research on soil amendments, and they're right in the West there, too, so might be able to help you with some of your work.
Okay, thanks.
Well, we're right about 4 o'clock right now. There was another cluster of questions that maybe I can try to put together in one question for you guys to cover additional questions that were submitted. It's kind of about plant selection. You know, lots of chemicals are toxic to plants, and then plants also have their own tolerances in terms of the soil conditions, the different vegetative zones or the climate zones that they will grow in. So is there I don't know, maybe a resource that is available to find vegetation that's suitable for various phytoremediation alternatives?
There absolutely is. The USDA publishes on the web, and I don't have a website off the top of my head, but they publish on the web native plants from different areas of the United States and maybe even beyond that. We've actually used that in developing some of our lists for screening.
The USDA Plant Materials group has a lot of that.
Uh-huh. It's not hard to Google and get that information, but that is also something I could try and send with the citations I'll send you, Heather.
USDA has a publication called VegSpec, VegSpec.
Huh.
I thought the EPA at one time had on their Clue Insight had a phytoremediation resource, but it might be ITRC I'm thinking of had a list of kind of a database of plants.
Yeah, ITRC may also. I should send that site also.
Great. And so for plants that maybe don't already have a tolerance to the toxic levels of metals, is there anything that you can do to manage the toxicity? To prevent killing the plants, or if a plant just does not tolerate it, is it better off picking another plant?
Well, there are some things you can do. For instance, a lot of if you're looking at metals, a lot of metals are the plant availability is very sensitive to pH. As pH increases, typically metal availability decreases because you start forming carbonates and hydroxides and things that are of lower solubility. And so as you lime the soil and raise that pH and you get closer to 7 and a little higher, a lot of those metals will drop out and you lose their plant availability. Your degree, you fertilize with things like phosphate, and particularly with things like lead and some of those elements, the phosphate will tend to tie those up and decrease your toxicity. So if you're looking at phytoextraction, you manage that the opposite way. Typically, there are some things you can do, but at a certain level, and some of the organic amendments also will tie up the metals and prevent them from... As you look at some of the biosolid materials, they'll tie those up and prevent them from being immediately soluble and available for uptake. So there's things like that you can do. But at some level, there's not much, you reach a point where you need to look at something that's tolerant as opposed to, you know, trying to manipulate the chemistry.
Yeah, I think the way to go about that is that we've certainly found there's no dearth of plants that can survive. And if there are certain plants you really want to grow on a site, it might just be better to wait until you've got a vegetative cap established, and then add them later.
Thanks for answering those questions. At this point, we're just past 4 o'clock. I'm going to open just to the phone lines again if there's a burning question. Okay, and from the silence, I'll conclude that there is not a burning question, but you're welcome to send those nonetheless. Before we conclude, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the last slide of the presentation. That slide contains links to the SBRP Risky Learning page, where you'll find links to archives to this and other Risky Learning seminars. There's also going to be a link to the additional resources page that was mentioned a few times, and we also have a survey, a feedback form that we'd like for you to have a look at. We definitely take a look at your comments and use that to improve our content and delivery mechanisms. So if you submitted an online question that we did not have a chance to get to, we'll ask Dr. Blaylock and Dr. Meyer to have a look and get back to you with those answers. And at this point, I'd like to thank our presenters, Dr. Blaylock and Dr. Meyer, for their presentations, and like to thank the audience for their participation. And at this time, I'd like to say goodbye.